Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. I am so excited about this podcast episode. For a little background, a couple years ago, Polk County in Iowa commissioned an extensive report describing the water resources in central Iowa. That report detailed, among other things, what's unique about Iowa waterways, the history of the land in Iowa, the flow of the rivers in the Des Moines and Raccoon River watersheds, as well as the many challenges facing our drinking water, our ecology, and our recreation. This report is, of course, hugely relevant for the residents of Iowa who have faced a plethora of water quality issues in recent years, including most recently a lawn watering ban in central Iowa, one which, by the way, happened when the world's most impressive and most expensive nitrate removal system could not keep up with the amount of nitrates impacting our waterways. But I also think people in other parts of the country will find this interesting because, as the report details, the nitrates impacting the waterways here are primarily coming from agricultural practices, including, of course, manure from confined animal feeding operations. And I will also add, as we'll see on this episode, the report covers a lot more about how current practices are impacting the water than just nitrates. A huge amount of work, 4,400 hours, went into this report from an impressive team of scientists across several disciplines. My institute, the Harkin Institute for Public Policy at Drake University, has partnered with Polk County for the first official presentation from the scientists behind the report on August 4th of 2025. So far, interest in this event has been absolutely through the roof. People are concerned about their health, they're concerned about their access to water, they're concerned about the costs needed to get safe water, and most of all, they're concerned about what the future holds. And the report covers all of those issues, so it's very understandable why interest in the presentation on August 4th is so high. And very excitingly, this podcast episode offers a preview of that presentation, as well as a presentation from some of the scientists who are not going to be present there. So joining me on this podcast, first of all, is Jennifer Terry, who is the project lead for Polk County. She's going to be joined by some of the impressive scientists who were behind the report, and that includes Dr. Claire Ruby, a geologist and environmental scientist from Drake University, Dr. Peter Levy, an ecologist with a passion for freshwater systems and nutrient cycling, Professor Keith Schilling, a leading voice in water resources and hydrology from the University of Iowa, Dr. Elliot Anderson, a rising star at the University of Iowa with deep expertise in data-driven water quality research, and Professor Mary Skopek, a beloved professor from the University of Iowa and the fearless leader of the Iowa Lakeside Laboratory. So with no further ado, I'm going to dive into the interview. I am really thrilled that all of you could join me today. I know that a huge amount of work went into this report, and I'm so excited that you guys are going to be able to present it because from everything I've seen, the public response to this has been huge. So your efforts are going to be well worth it. And thank you so much for joining me here to preview a little bit of the August 4th event. I thought it might be nice to start out by talking to Jennifer first, since you were the project lead. And I was hoping you could tell me a little bit about the process of how the project came about, how you decided to assemble scientists, how you thought about this huge question of addressing the task that you were given.
Thanks, Adam. And thank you to you and the Harkin Institute for bringing so much attention to the CISRA project and the reports. I agree there's been a lot of interest, and hopefully this will help spur action as well. So back in 2022, I was invited by Polk County to join a small group of people who were water quality enthusiasts around the metro and around the state to talk about a possible project that the county could commission using American Rescue Plan Act money. And so we started talking about how everybody who works in water and recreation or drinking water around Iowa always gets the question, well, what's in the water, especially around central Iowa? What's in the water? What's in the rivers? And so we set about deciding what kind of a project could it be where we figure out what sort of pollutants are in the Des Moines and Raccoon rivers and how do we let the public know about that and get them interested in order to take action to protect the rivers. And so it all started started out with a small group of John Norris from the county and Pat Bodie and Dr. Mary Skopek with Lakeside Laboratory, who's on the podcast today, as well as a couple of other folks from the county, John Swanson and others. So we just started talking about what this could look like. And then we put the project description together and the county decided they needed either a consultant or a temporary employee to take this over. And so I applied for the job and I was thrilled to get it. And I started working on this project way back in March of 2023. So my first order of business was to figure out how we were going to figure out what pollutants of concern were in the Des Moines and Raccoon River, because my background is in law and policy, not science. And so over the past 12 years, I've gotten to know lots of people who are experts in the field of water quality and other disciplines. And so I started reaching out to some of those folks. Recruitment of the science advisors was a very long and thoughtful process that took months. So I started with Mary because she already was one of the originators of the project. And we started putting together a list of people to talk to. People inside of Iowa that know Iowa water quality issues, but people outside of Iowa around the country who have expertise in lots of different backgrounds that we needed to answer this question of what's in the rivers. And so I went out and started recruiting the folks that we wanted. And I think Mary uses the word an unimpeachable group of advisors. And so I feel like that we were very successful in finding that group. We were able to attract a group and they were all enthusiastic about this project. We ended up having 16 experts, very broad and very deep levels of expertise in multiple disciplines with multiple diverse perspectives and backgrounds. And that's what we wanted. We wanted rigorous, robust analysis and conversation around these topics. And that's exactly what we got. So 4,400 hours later of data collection, analysis, spirited discussion, and months of writing and editing to issue our full reports, here we are. So Mary, would you have anything to add as the science co-lead?
Thanks, Jennifer. You know, I think that you summarized it very well. Our goal was to know really everything we could about water quality in the rivers. Sometimes we get to be a little tunnel vision and we only talk about a couple of parameters. We really wanted to be as comprehensive as possible and to not only look at nitrate, everyone's favorite contaminant, but also to think about fish and bugs and the things that live in the rivers, and really wanted to have experts from the universities represented as well as national and state experts. So really trying to have as broad a reach as we could without having an agenda other than to understand what's in the rivers and then to provide some action steps. So really trying to be as open as we could to the data. We didn't have the time or money to collect a lot of new data. So we're looking at information that's in existence already, really leveraging the information that's out there, maybe repackaging it, relooking at it, doing some new analyses, and again, being as comprehensive as possible.
Great, thank you. And so Professor Skopek and Dr. Anderson, you guys were the scientific leads. How did you approach this monumental task in terms of organizing everything? Did you know how much work it was going to be from the very beginning? Was it something that came up as you started working on it?
Well, I think we knew there was going to be a lot of work involved. There's a lot of information, a lot of data that lives in a variety of different locations. I don't know that anybody's really tried to comprehensively bring all that information together. And we knew we were going to need somebody who was excellent at data management and data synthesis. And Dr. Elliott was the right person at the right time to do that. He's done yeoman's work in organizing, cleaning this information up and working on it. So Elliott, you want to jump in there?
Sure. Thanks, Mary. Yeah, one of the biggest challenges that we had from the outset was trying to wrap our heads around what current resources were available for us to use and give an adequate state of the report as to what had been going on within Polk County for the past several years. And so a big chunk of time at the very beginning of this project was dedicated to familiarizing ourselves with all of the best, highest quality data sets that were available. So these were from some of our key community partners. So names that probably most of your listeners will be familiar with. These are people like the U.S. Geological Survey, the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. What we did was we went and we looked at all of their monitoring locations within our study area, which was Polk County, but also the rest of its upstream watershed. And we found out all of the data that was available within these areas. And then there was a bit of work on our end to summarize that. So making it all available and comprehensible to the advisors so that they could understand the data sets that we were dealing with. And then also do some work to bring it together to try to make something that was greater than the sum of its parts. So It was a lot of looking into what had been collected historically, figuring out how we could present that in a comprehensible way, and then using that to produce the ultimate findings that ended up in the reports that you guys see in front of you today.
Well, I think you did a wonderful job of it. One of the things I was most impressed with was the use of graphics. The way you visualized a lot of the data was really helpful and impressive and understandable, even for a layperson. Was that something that was a conscious decision on your part going into it? How did that come about where it integrates graphics so effectively?
I'll jump in there, Adam, because I'm not a scientist. And so I was always the one asking, what does that mean? I would always say, please. Write it in a way that we could understand it or talk about it. And then we worked with a consulting firm who has great graphic designers who did a great job of really synthesizing that information, processing it, and putting it out into a format that they really understood. And I would say that the data collection, analysis, review, and reporting took thousands of hours. We had hundreds of meetings to do that. But then we also had hundreds of meetings in small groups and teams and large groups to do the writing. So the writing and editing was a huge piece of this as well, because it was so important to this team to get it right. And I believe that they did that. And I couldn't be more pleased with the result, but it was just diligence and tenacity to bring it across the finish line, you know, almost a 2-year writing project, basically.
I would add, Adam, that I think it's really important that as scientists, we think of how to make our work and the review of scientific literature accessible for leaders at the county level, at the city level, at the state level. And so that was really important to us from the beginning. Jen and Mary and Elliot set a good tone that we couldn't just do science for scientists, but rather this report was for the masses and for people to understand. So we took that really seriously and wanted to make sure our science was accessible for everyone.
Yeah, it was done so well. There's the report itself, which could look intimidating for people, but there's also the summary report. And I also think if people are interested, it's pretty easy to just pick one of the chapters and dive in on a particular topic, whether it's drinking water or recreation. It's really quite effectively communicated in the draft of the text. I did want to spend some time diving into the content a little bit. Of course, as we mentioned, there's going to be a fuller presentation on August 4th, but to give a little preview of some of the great information that's going to be presented on August 4th, I wanted to touch on all of the different topic areas. I thought I would start with the one that people are clamoring about the most in the Des Moines region, which is drinking water. We just recently had some restrictions on water usage because we're having trouble keeping up with the nitrates in the rivers. So I was wondering if someone could jump in and talk a little bit about some of the findings from the chapter on drinking water.
Here, I could say a few words about the drinking water chapter. As you mentioned, throughout the entirety of this project, nitrate was top of mind, and it certainly has been for many residents of Polk County over the past couple of months. And so with nitrate and several other pollutants, what we really tried to do was tell the full story of how things are the way they are today, and then eventually what the implications for those are and how we can make those better. So just with nitrate specifically, it's perhaps Iowa's most famous or most well-known water quality pollutant. So what we tried to do with this report is really show that the nitrate levels that we see in and around Polk County today are the result of human activities since the advent of settlement within Polk County over 100 years ago. These are the decisions that have led to nitrate conditions that are far above the natural level, and they have many ramifications down the line to the consumers of Des Moines Water Works' finished water that they distribute to its residents today. And so what we wanted to show with this report is that nitrate has really been an issue over the past several decades. So this is something Des Moines Water Works has struggled with for a while. And you hear some of the statistics that they throw around about it being very expensive and very cumbersome to treat. But what happens with nitrate is that it's really always at the forefront of their minds. They've always been proactive in coming up with new ways to ensure that they can meet the regulated nitrate drinking standards that people have put in place. But it's been pretty challenging for them. And that's really come to a head over these past couple of months or so. And what we tried to stress in this report is that it really takes a team effort, all aspects of society, to address something that's as ubiquitous as the high nitrate levels that we see within Polk County. And so through these suggested action steps, we've tried to put out that there are many things we can do, many different strategies that we can potentially take. And so nitrate's a challenging issue. It's going to remain a challenging issue for the years to come, but it's something that we all need to think about really throughout most of Iowa.
Definitely. And I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of questions about that on August 4th. So excited to dive in more to that topic. And also, since you mentioned the settlement of Polk County, I'll just throw in that another thing I really liked about the report was describing the history of the land and the entire watershed. It really goes into nice depth about understanding the broader context of things. Dr. Levy, you worked on the ecosystem chapter. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about some of the things that you discovered during the writing of that chapter.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. What I was just thinking about as Elliot was describing that was as ecologists, as hydrologists, and scientists more broadly, one thing that we're trained to do from early on is to compare the results of our study to other previous studies. That's why it's so important to know the literature, know the scientific foundations from which we're building our studies and our work. And when you start to compare some of the measurements of streams and rivers in Iowa to streams and rivers elsewhere, you can really start to see how starkly different Iowa streams and rivers are in terms of nitrate concentration, in terms of sediment load. And I lived in Iowa for 7 years, from January 2016 until mid-2022. And nitrate was in the news a lot. And I think that what happens is we become so numb to things that we hear often about. And Iowa really is an outlier when it comes to things like ecological health and the different pollutants in the streams and rivers, that it's easy to lose sight of how the numbers in Iowa compare to other states. And so I think that's a really important part of the work we did. It's easy to take pride in thinking and hearing the slogan. I heard this often when I lived in Iowa, Iowa feeds the world. So it's often easy to take pride in ways that a state or a geography leads in a good and positive way that gives people warm feelings. But then I think it's also important to take a hard look too and really evaluate when you're leading in things that are less good and less warm and fuzzy, like nitrate concentrations in water. So when it comes to the ecological health of these streams and rivers, one thing that really stood out to me were the number of fish kills and how often there were massive fish kills in these watersheds. And I think, again, this is something that happens on occasion, but with enough regularity and enough frequency that people might just read the headline and move on and not stop to think about, is this normal? Is this happening elsewhere? And it's not happening to nearly the frequency in other states, even other states with high agricultural production, high industries related to agriculture. And it's oftentimes written off as a mistake or an oversight. You know, there was a fertilizer spill that led to hundreds of thousands of dead fish in a stream. And of course, these streams connect to larger streams, which ultimately connect to the Des Moines and Raccoon Rivers, which ultimately connect to the Mississippi River. So these issues are deeply interconnected. And something that I took from this work and this report is thinking about Iowa in the context of other states. There is industrial agriculture elsewhere. There are similar issues elsewhere, but in a way, some of these issues are more unique to Iowa, at least with the regularity and frequency that they come about.
You're so right about that. I do think the fish kills are something that it's easy to be numb to, or you just hear about it periodically every now and then. But every one of those events is a huge event from an ecological perspective, and it's important to not get over numb to that. So thank you for that. Also, your point about Iowa being number one is interesting because Art Cullen, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist from Iowa, also had a column today where he referenced this idea of Iowa being number one in some areas that we might not want to be. So I guess great minds were on the same wavelength. Professor Schilling, I wanted to ask you about the flow of the river and some of your work on that chapter. I guess, first of all, could you explain why people need to understand more about how the river flows and how that impacts our lives? And what are some of the things that you found when working on that topic?
Yeah, it's been the conversation about nitrate and sediment. Well, the river flow is the carrier of those materials. So if we're interested about something concentration of whatever constituent in the water, you got to follow the water. So the river flow starts as precip, flows across the land. There's a lot of land use, land cover impacts on how that stream flow is captured, infiltrated, or runs off. And then it ends up in the river, where it can contribute to peak flows and floods. It contributes to high river flows during quiet times, like base flow. And it is ultimately the carrier of all these pollutants that we're interested in.
That makes sense. And I'm guessing it's one of the many ways in which water quality might be impacted by climate change as well, where some of the changes in rain patterns could have a big effect.
Sure. It's definitely getting wetter. We're seeing an increase in precip to some degree, 20% or so over the last 80 years. And also contributes to high flow events. We've seen an increase in the flow events above certain thresholds, like the really big events. So overall, the flows every year has gone up some, but it's really the top of that distribution that's increased. So we see those contributions increase a lot. And part of that excess water around the system is increasing base flow, the increasing groundwater contribution to stream flow. So average flows are going up, mainly because the low flows are going up. And one of the major contributors to low flow and base flows is tile drainage. So it just kind of comes full circle that we started the conversation with nitrate. The primary delivery of nitrate to our streams is tile drainage, and that contributes to rising stream flow in the watersheds.
Thank you, Dr. Ruby. Really excited to have Drake representation on the panel. Thank you so much for joining us. So you worked on the recreation chapter in particular. Can you say more about some of the things that jumped out to you?
Absolutely. So the recreation chapter consisted of four main topics. One that is in the news this month especially is E. coli at beaches and microcystin at beaches. So E. coli and the pathogens that it may or may not indicate is one section. Cyanotoxins like microcystin that come from those harmful algal blooms is another section. One thing that is difficult about this report was organizing, because all of these pieces fit together, the nitrate impacts, the cyanotoxins, et cetera. So picking ways to organize it was a bit of a challenge. Antibiotic resistance and what we do and don't know about antibiotic resistance was highlighted in this chapter. And I think one of the main conclusions from that is that we have some holes in our data set. There's things we really don't know. And if we want to do a good job protecting public health, we need to be consistent about monitoring and have a plan for that moving forward. And the last section in that recreation chapter is about fishing. And we definitely learned a lot about how important fishing recreation is, especially in Polk County, and how diverse the population is, and how important fishing is for providing food and sustenance for people. And there are risks related to that. If we don't know what's in the water and we don't know what's in the fish tissue, there are some potential hazards there. So there may be some holes in our data, but we put together as much of a summary of that. And also in all of this chapter, trying to highlight how people can take precaution or gather more information. So those are the four topics. The thing that's standing out to me, at least in the last week, is how many misconceptions there are about water quality. I think all of us have been interviewed a few times in the last month, and we really have to go back and talk about different ways of measuring nitrate, or the fact that E. coli is a huge family of organisms, most of which don't make us sick. We all have them in our guts, but six strains can make people especially sick. And we're measuring the whole family and then trying to understand risk from that. And so things like explaining the standards. Why is the standard 10 for nitrate? Why is the standard 235 for E. coli in recreation? It seems like a pretty arbitrary number, and people misunderstand it. They think if it's less than the standard, we're safe completely, everything's great. And if we're above the standard, we're going to die. And that's not really what's happening. It's a measure of risk. It's not a perfect measure. And so I'm really excited, starting with this report, to move forward and overcome some of those misconceptions. But I encourage everybody to read this chapter, because Elliot has put together some great maps and graphics so we can see The concentration of bacteria in rivers is by far higher than at any of our beaches. And the concentrations we measure at beaches overall for the whole watershed is higher than any open water samples for E. coli. So if people are just taking that overall conclusion into consideration for their risk, it's generally safer to be recreating, especially kayaking in the open water in a lake than at the beach, and probably safer at the beach than at a nearby river. Those are really generic, non-specific conclusions, but then we narrow down. And the one last thing I wanted to say about that is that there are some good news stories in here too. It's not all bad news. So there have been some concerted efforts at some of our lakes to reduce inputs. And when you get a significant portion of the landowners in a watershed working together, there have been decreases in the cyanotoxins at some beaches. We hope those are maintained over time. Sometimes projects funding comes and goes, and when people stop paying attention, we backslide a little bit. So again, just highlighting the importance of monitoring moving forward. But we do point out some good news, and everybody is talking now about either regulation or voluntary management of our watersheds. But I'm hoping that we talk more in detail about what that really means. Regulation doesn't mean prohibiting CAFOs. It means thinking about what some of the practices are and how to do them better. And so I'm hoping that there's a little bit more nuance to the conversation than all or nothing as we move forward.
So the good news leads me to something I wanted to ask everybody, which is, how do you see the trajectory of water quality over the past couple decades? Do you feel like the positive things that have been put in place, if we continue along the path that we're going, are they going to be sufficient to address the water quality challenges that we're facing? Should we expect more lawn watering restrictions in the future? Should we expect more fish kills in the future? How do you see the overall trajectory of things if we assume there was not some huge change of direction from where we are currently?
I can jump in quick on that one, Adam. As a stream and river ecologist, as my colleagues are as well, and hydrologists and other stream and river scientists, what's really frustrating is that there seems to be a lot of discussion about how to improve or restore the river or the stream bank or the riparian area, which is the land immediately adjacent to a stream or river. How do we fix this problem with water quality? And it always starts in the stream and river. And once these issues are there, as my colleague Dr. Schilling mentioned, we're increasing the amount of flow. As Dr. Anderson mentioned, there's more nitrate. As Dr. Ruby said, the bacteria are many and diverse. And we have to stop thinking about fixing the rivers, and we have to think about the landscape. As Des Moines Water Works says in their slogan, think upstream, and everyone lives downstream of somewhere. So even as you go up a watershed and you get into smaller and smaller streams, we can't even just think about fixing those streams, but we have to get onto the landscape. We have to get into the fields. We have to think about how much fertilizer is being applied to these fields on an annual basis. And we have to think about our land management that we do on the landscape.
I'm going to jump in and say, I think I'm the only one in this group who, besides you, Adam, who drinks the water and recreates in it regularly now. So this is personal to me and the livelihood of my kid and my stepkids. And so I don't think the trajectory, if we stay on it, we don't make big moves, is going to get us where we need to go. And that's going to have major impacts. Folks like me who know better might put in a treatment system in our houses. Maybe we can afford it. But we're also going to think about maybe there's a better place to be where I can get my kid in the water safely and I don't have to spend a lot of money on drinking water. It's part of the consideration of where you want to live and stay for a long period of time. So I don't think it's enough. I think there's a lot of great work happening. I mean, let's give credit where credit is due to the watershed groups and the researchers and folks at Iowa State who are getting good practices on the ground and solving problems. But if our landscape is a bell curve, I feel like we've hit the top 20%, maybe, if we're being generous. We have 5 to 10% of that land in cover crops. We need 50. We need 75%. We need all of those acres to have some level of treatment, whether it's the wetland or the cover crops. And we need to have some basic standards. What is too much fertilizer? There's a limit to what our land can handle, and we should be explicit about that. It doesn't mean we stop fertilizing. It doesn't mean we get rid of manure, but we need to understand where the limits are. There are certain parts of our watersheds where there's too much nutrients, and there's other parts that could take more. But we need to dive into those details. And I am originally from Minnesota, but I always say Minnesota does it first. Iowa could do it better. I think we can be more precise about how we do it if we're serious. We need to fund the monitoring if we're serious, because you can't tell a story and figure out if we're making a difference if we don't have those continuous nitrate monitors in place. If we're serious, we have to do that. That's step one. Everything else comes after that. If we just saw news about Beaver Creek watershed and millions of dollars being put in there, is there monitoring associated with it? Can we tell the story of the improvements that are going to be made? So yes, we can do this, but our current trajectory just isn't enough to make us safe.
I'll weigh in for one thing as well. As we put this report together, I think I was struck, and maybe others are struck, by the scientists working in here. The science is, it looks like a lot, but we already know this. The science is relatively simple in many ways. And so solving this is not a science question. It's political, it's economic, it's social. The science is the easy part, and we got it all documented here. We know what needs to be done. So I would leave people with the idea that this is not a science question to be solved like an equation. There's all the other aspects that are going to be the difference maker here, not what we lay out in this report.
It sounds like you guys did your job, but now it's up to other people to pick up the baton and carry things forward.
The way we constructed the report, it provides a pathway for that. So if readers at the local level, at the watershed level working together, or at the state level, there's a recipe in there for how to go about starting. There's no way the county could do all these things financially, and also they just don't have control over the whole watershed. So it's going to take a community watershed effort in a lot of ways, but there's great pathways in there. In the executive summary, we put a piece in there called What Concerns Us Most. That's a great place to start. And then at the end of the report, there's very detailed ideas on what we can do as individuals in Polk County and what we can do as members of organizations and members of state. So Dr. Shilley makes a great point about it. The science is here. Now, what are we going to do with it? How are we going to take action?
Last question. If there's one thing that you want the reader of this report to take away, what would that be?
Adam, that's a great question. And I've been an educator for 20 plus years. I'm passionate about sharing science and sharing nature with others. And I think it's really important for people to get to know their watershed, get to know the stream or creek that runs near their house. Where is that connected downstream? Where is it connected upstream? To think more broadly about where they live on the landscape. That's something everyone can do to start to think about how they're connected to these places and to become better informed of what's impacting their local waterways, from the hyperlocal right outside their back door.
I would add, although this was funded by Polk County and has a Polk County emphasis, communities all through the watershed and all through the state are struggling with the same issues. And so we know there are communities with one well, and that well is over 10 milligrams per liter nitrate. So it's not just an urban issue. Maybe this report was pretty urban focused in a lot of ways. And to be honest, there's a fair amount more data here in Polk County than up the rest of the watershed. So that drives the analysis as well. But this report actually speaks to the rest of the state as well.
I certainly thought so. Anyone have something else to add?
I'll just jump in. I think that we're seeing a time of tremendous change currently. And I think that this report should encourage people to think creatively. We always talk about out-of-the-box thinking. And if ever there was a time to think about out-of-the-box thinking, it's now. There's a lot of uncertainty in the future for producers and environmental folks and just a lot of folks in the state. Now's the time to really think about some creative solutions in ways that we're getting more food production. I think we're all excited to see more perennial food production might be a way to solve a lot of problems for a lot of people. And so thinking about how we can take this information and really take a big leap forward in a way that we haven't in a long time, because I think there's a certain aspect of the treadmill that we all have engaged with being on that treadmill and getting off that long enough to come up with solutions that are unique may be a big help for us.
If no one else has anything to add, I just want to thank you all so much for being part of this conversation and for your 4,400 hours of work that was done for citizens of Polk County and for residents of Iowa. It's a tremendous resource, and I hope as many people as possible get familiar with the report, listen to the presentation on August 4th, and think about how to pick up the baton from y'all and make some changes that are needed. That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, which includes X, Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at parkininstitute@drake.edu. And this podcast is also hosted by Substack Canary in a Cornfield, which will include some additional links and resources that go beyond just what's in the episode. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.